we're back.
It's July the 22nd. Are we really back before I go through this whole deal?
Looks like it.
We're back, and it's Tuesday night, and it's the Linux show. My comment based upon last week that I talked for 5 minutes, not realizing that the show wasn't on the air. But we're back, and it is a regular Tuesday night edition. The whole crew is here. It's a hot summer night here in Chicago, but we will somehow plow through and have a pretty good show tonight. The equipment seems stable. We've got an awful lot to talk about, so let's go ahead and welcome in the whole crew. How are you doing tonight, Doc?
I'm doing great. We're having an install fest here. I've got the little Lindos laptop has a new Lindos Debian OS on it. Works really well. I've got the big Linux box is getting Red Hat on it this time. and I've got a friend here, Donald Burr, who's big with the Santa Barbara lug, sblug.org. And so he's getting me religion as well as helping me re-network everything. And it's just been it's been a cooler day here, which is nice. So going out in the big old truck that I've borrowed, because my wife's car crapped out and she's borrowing my car, that has no air conditioning, is not quite as miserable as it usually is. So it's been a fun day. And it looks like he'll be done with what he's doing, and not long after we're done with this, you know, around 7 o'clock my time, we'll be up with at least two new machines, maybe three. So that'll be kind of fun.
Well, give us a progress report towards the end of the show.
Yeah, we'll see.
Arnie, I was watching Weather Channel, and they told me it was hotter than blazes down by where you live.
Oh, it's just the last 2 or 3 weeks. You know, it's like triple digits every day. We had a little bit of relaxation of that when the remnants of that hurricane that hit Texas went through here the other day.
You got a little taste of that, then.
Yeah, well, I think two drops fell on Ontario. Yeah.
We had the same thing. It was like, oh my God, it's like humidity and weird clouds. And that was
two drops.
Yeah.
And that's about it. It's hotter in blazes here, but today's not too bad.
Yeah, the guy at
perfect earthquake weather.
The guy on the Weather Channel was traffic from a drugstore in the Death Valley area that was selling suntan lotion that was SPF 1,000,000.
It's basically a lead shield you plaster on your body.
To metallize your skin.
Yeah.
So how are you doing out there on the opposite end of the country, Russ?
Oh, hanging in. I'm in the land of thunderstorms tonight. They were talking about potential 60-mile-an-hour winds and penny-sized hail. So if I suddenly go dark, you know what happened.
Yeah.
Take out a phone transformer or something. But life out here is, we're surviving. No, don't quite have the heat that Arnie's been dealing with, but it's been plenty warm. And, we're getting rid of some of the humidity tonight in terms of water.
Yeah. Well, we're having just a typical July here in the Chicago area, aren't we, Kevin? It has been really spectacular here in the Midwest. This is prime season for unbelievably powerful thunderstorms. And last night I was on the upstairs of my house standing at a window watching a thunderstorm that was about 10 to 15 miles from my house. And the thunderstorm was totally stationary. It wasn't very big around. It was probably at a radius of maybe 15 to 20 miles. And it was totally stationary. It was sitting right on top of a relatively small city here in Illinois called Joliet. And Joliet was being nailed by a lightning blast approximately every 10 seconds for about a solid hour before the winds finally loosened up enough to let the storm move on. It just sat stationary on top of the downtown area of Joliet, just tearing the town up. Not typical here in the Chicago area. We have those bizarre microcells in July, these really, really weird storms that form up at a moment's notice and just devastate everything that they're over, and there's nothing else around them. I mean, there's no, you know, bad storms around them. They just hit real small isolated areas.
You know, if you could go to weather.com and type in Washington, D.C., the radar there for us has a lot of real big cells. I mean, that's just green, but yellow and red.
Yeah, we
moving
have,
over them right now. It looks pretty ugly.
We have the really cool bright red ones all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
That's our weather here. That's typical. And you guys say you haven't had any rain. I think we've probably already in July probably had, I don't know, maybe 7-8 inches of rain already.
Wow.
Just poured. Poured like crazy. And then a couple weeks from now it'll dry up and we won't have another drop through all of August and most of September. That's why farmers love this area.
Yeah.
The ideal place to grow crops. So let's go ahead and jump right into the first segment. Man, do we have news this week. And so, obviously, I think we should probably kick off the discussion with non-SCO item. Because I'm afraid that if we start with SCO items, we may end up, you know, waking up and it's 8 o'clock, or 9 o'clock, I should say, and the whole damn show's gone and we haven't talked about anything but SCO. So why don't we pick up with some of the non-SCO items that are on the list. Russ, do you want to grab one of your stories and we'll move around the panel?
Sure, and this one I got a feeling will definitely move around the panel. This one actually has no direct Linux content, but it is important that we realize what's going on in the industry. I mean, as if the stuff with SCO and whatnot isn't bad enough. It has to do with DirecTV and how some people, you know, of course, are trying to buy these various devices to do evil and nefarious things like be able to watch programming that DirecTV says that they're not entitled to watch. But other people use the very same devices to do very normal and reasonable things. And unfortunately, as DirecTV is now deciding that they're going to track down on all these pirates, they are accusing people, some of whom don't even have DirecTV, of being pirates, and making them this magnanimous offer that if they pay $3,500 immediately, they'll consider them settled up, and also give out the smart card programmer. That's the thing that's being debated here, a smart card programmer that apparently DirecTV pirates use, but other people use for other legitimate reasons.
Oh yeah, I mean this is nuts. This is an obvious. This was a story that was at the top of my list too. This story is all over the place on most of major news portals, as well as a real good write up is on. My mind goes blank. The Register.
Right.
We have a link for the Register story on our website. But anyways, back when Kevin and I were at WWA in the early 90s, we had one of these reprogramming gadgets for making security cards for sysadmins to plug into servers so that they could do the things that sysadmins need to do. And there are ISPs all over the country that have got these gadgets that are used in them for perfectly legitimate reasons, but because of our friend, and who is our friend? The Digital Millennium Copyright Act!
Yay!
Because of the DMCA and its use as a club instead of a solution, has now made perfectly legitimate technologies illegal, and that, as is evidenced in some of the people that are in the story by the Register, their behaviors have been deemed illegal, and they are liable, even though they were using these devices for completely different industry groups, separate and distinct from anything that DirecTV is using. I think this is an absolute atrocity that this has been allowed to happen. The letter, I tried to get a copy of the letter. It's been described in a number of different articles. The letter that WebTV is sending out is no less heavy-handed, not WebTV, DirecTV, excuse me, but it's no less heavy-handed than the letters that Microsoft Small Business Alliance was sending it out a few months ago on software piracy. And so they're right in there with them. It's very, very evil indeed.
Yeah, and the thing here that I think most of community's got to be aware of is that, you know, even when you're doing something that is correct these days, that's not good enough. You know, we have to cross every T and dot every I, because it's very clear that in the legal field, particularly in the U.S. right now, is a minefield for technology. And so even things that we know to be innocuous and we know to be reasonable things to do may be brutally attacked by companies that are wielding the DMCA club. So basically, we have to keep our eyes open regardless of what we do.
That's because the lawmakers aren't the people who understand the technology, and they're using the laws like a blunt club to outlaw potentialities instead of outlawing behavior.
Yeah.
I think the law, what's made against the law ought to be behavior. And to heck with the potentiality, because as soon as you cross that Rubicon of saying, well, this technology has the potential for misuse, so we should need to outlaw it entirely, you're swatting a fly with a nuclear weapon.
And that seems to be a trend these days. I mean, across the board, one of the things that actually comes to my mind about this was, I think it was a few months back, there was a big sweep by the U.S. Justice Department against internet head shops, basically people that sell bongs and things of the sort, because it is technically illegal to sell drug paraphernalia. It doesn't have to be drugs, just pipes or associated things are considered illegal. And once again, it's because of the potential.
You mean they're no longer classified as decorations or sculpture?
apparently not, according to the Justice Department. I mean, they apparently closed down a bunch of those, the big ones, from what I was reading on the web. And so, I mean, this seems to be getting to be kind of in vogue to, you know, I don't know whether it's some sort of knee-jerk reaction from the whole September 11th thing about needing to take preemptive strikes, but these preemptive strikes are going in all directions against all things.
You could make a bong out of a toilet paper roll. I wonder if they'll outlaw toilet paper rolls.
No, you could not, Artie. You would get all wet and soggy.
But, you know, but this seems to be the legal climate these days.
This is definitely bordering on the thought police type thing, especially with this DirecTV dragnet as an example. It really is ridiculous, not only from the standpoint of what you said, but they really are legislating the existence of a single technology over any other technology in the future, because that any other technology in the future might by somebody someday, somewhere, somehow be used in a matter that could circumvent somebody's copyright. And so, you know, the future of consumer electronics does look bleak in situations like this. It really does. It is an ugly story, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So, well, on to a more interesting technology story that's not quite as depressing, is the story on about Windows. Normally I'm the one sitting up going, saying negative things about Windows, but I want to give them their kudos when the kudos are due. And I knew it was only a matter of time before somebody did this. The last sub-$199 Linux PC came out, when was it, 1999 or 2000, by the Linux Store or something like that. And although it was a little bit more expensive than the new release from Windows at $169 for the Windows Web Station, it was only a matter of time before somebody attempted to do a CD-ROM-based system as opposed to a hard drive-based system. But I don't know. It's cheap. It's a great concept. But I gotta believe, from a standpoint of managing memory, this has got to really be kludgy. They've only got, from what I understand, at least on the specifications, it's really hard to be precise in the specifications because they have made a couple errors on the specification sheet at our website that we've got a link up for the spec sheet for the Windows Web Station. But they have 128 meg of DDR RAM, and you know, yeah, a machine will work at 128 meg, but having no drive, no slot memory, and so that is going to be difficult for an awful lot of applications to run. But it does really open up some avenues for thought, for perhaps taking as gigabytes of memory become affordable in the future for doing that and not bothering with swap memory. Is anybody else taking a look at the Windows Web Station? I know, Doc, you said not at all.
You're
loading Windows.
Off my radar. Oh, you said Windows or Windows?
Windows.
Windows with an L.
Yeah.
Boy, that was not clear to me. I was sitting here thinking, that just isn't making sense. No, I haven't. I haven't.
This is Windows Linux, a web station at $169.
Oh, okay. No, I have not. Oh, yeah, I heard about that today.
Well, the link is on the website. Go look at it.
Yeah.
And now the system looks reasonably well. A 700 megahertz CPU, 120 mega RAM, reasonable graphics card. It doesn't come with a lot of extras because, I mean, there's only so much you can fit on a CD-ROM drive. But if your goal is delivering a box that'll go on the net and type a letter, it'll do it. So, well, I guess you haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but Doc.
No, but I'll. You know what? I'm sure I will get a chance to look at it. I have not. You're right. I have not had a chance, and it looks like another fun little project. Something I can plug into the new 8-port router in the workshop. In the 8-port hub in the workshop, which I picked up today.
Do you have any stories of the week?
No, actually, there's a new piece. It's not so much a story. I think there is this kind of goes back to the earlier item, kind of about how the big guys are interested in corrupting the net down as deep in the stack as they can stick it, and it's a piece that I just wrote for Linux Journal. It just went up today. I didn't even know it was there. I know it's been coming for a while. I actually wrote it about a month ago. I don't know why it's been in the queue as long as it has exactly. But it doesn't matter. It's about what the political challenges are coming up and what's happening right now. I just think that there's the call to action that Larry Lessig made a year ago, I think, and I said this last week or the week before, but it's kind of high in my mind. I think there's a real opportunity for people to get involved and start making a difference. I think that there's a line by Jim Moore. Jim Moore wrote The Death of Competition about 7 years ago, and he's a Berkman fellow, teaches at Harvard. And on his site, last week, he dropped a line. He said, the best networks win. And I don't know why, that just blew my mind, because I think that in the long run, the geeks of the world are better networked than the TV addicted schlubs of the world. Are we all still here?
Yep.
Oh, I wasn't sure. It got quiet, so I wasn't sure. Anyway, like we've been on the air before, you know, and they're just talking, and who knew, nothing was there, like last week or the week before. And I just think that there's a huge potential here for political action of all kinds, and not of that sort of frustrated sort that's, you know, we're the powerless and we just demand that the big powers tell us what to do, but rather we can mobilize a lot of voters and we can educate a lot of people, and we're going to do it. And I don't know if it'll happen before this next election or not. I have a feeling a lot of it will. I think a lot of it will. It is very interesting to see on the Democrat. There's no way to see it on the Republican side. Actually, the Bush people are really very well networked, I think. And I think there's a lot of people on the net, the old war blogging community for one, that are very much behind Bush and providing intellectual support that he desperately needs. But on the Democratic side, there are a lot of hackers around the Dean thing. And the significant thing there is that a lot of money was raised from a lot of people in a very short time, just thanks to networking. This can be done, and as a result, you've got a candidate who is going out of his way to withhold his opinions to see what the democracy wants. It's very interesting to see. And I'm not advocating Dean necessarily. I'm just saying I think we've got a laboratory, a kind of a controlled experiment going on here. And because people who are kind of doing it the old way, like Kerry, for example, seem to be a little bit lost about this whole internet thing. I wrote about 4,000 words, and it's up. It's a top item on the Linux Journal site right now. So that's one thing. The other thing is that Gartner. There's a piece on. You can find it on Google. If you go to Google and just type in Linux in Google News, I think it's the second or third item. The first non-SCO item is about how Gartner is. Has been saying, it's in the Register, Gardner's been saying that maybe Munich made the wrong decision or something like that, that the cost differences between Linux and Windows are not that large. And it actually highlights something that came up at the Open Source Convention a couple of weeks ago after I gave a talk. One of the guys in the audience came up to me, and he's an IT guy with the company. A lot of IT guys, just rank and file IT guys were there. And he said he went to a Gartner thing a few weeks earlier, and he said it was just an expensive thing to go to, and he said he got far more out of any hour at the Open Source Convention than he got out of like 2 days of Gartner talking. He thought that they were not clued into what's actually happening with Linux and what's actually happening with open source and understanding what actual customers are doing when you don't look at the marketplace from the vendor perspective, which I think is the most toxic thing that we have right now. What's really happening is all on the customer side. And when customers are not buying products but in fact rolling their own solutions, it just doesn't show up for the analyst. And I think there's a huge opportunity for somebody out there to start a new analyst shop of some kind, a new analyst house. I can say as a journalist, we desperately need the data, and we need people to go out and research that data, and we're not getting it. So anyway, that's not news, but it's interesting. I think.
Yeah?
Yep. There you go.
There you go. It is interesting. I'm sitting here trying to digest all the different threads at one time. I've been thinking a lot about the impact of what's going on within the blogger community and some of the more active communities out there, and how it is indeed impacting politics for the first time, really. This is the first really active internet national campaign. And I hope it doesn't do one thing, and there really is a danger of that. I hope it doesn't change candidates to the point where they're constantly sticking their finger up in the air based upon internet polls and jumping right and left.
God, they'll be going every which way because internet polls are not very scientific.
Well, I don't think it's a case of internet polls as much as what we have right now, and that I rather like. And of course, I like the way the wind is blowing in this one microclimate at the moment because it's blowing a way that I like. Of course, you know, for once we have. I don't know if you know Larry Lessig, who is basically a Kucinich supporter, I believe, and an Edwards supporter. I forget which one. I think more Edwards than Kucinich, but if he's listening, if he can correct me, I hope. But he turned his blog over to Howard Dean for a week. And it was a really interesting thing. I think the Dean people actually got kind of clobbered by, you know, it certainly was Slashdot. They'd never been sort of Slashdot. I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments, probably thousands. Overall, very much like Slashdot, maybe even the same people that just jumped on to say stuff, you know. But the, you know, the need to defeat the, you know, to repeal the DMCA, to come up with sane copyright laws, to pry Washington and to pry legislation and rulemaking and regulatory. Enforcement out of the hands of the entertainment industry and of other special interest lobbies that have bought their way in there, and to respect the end-to-end nature of the net, and as much as possible do that, you know, with legislation and rulemaking that's sane and sensitive. Those things are all suddenly, you know, playing, and they were hopeless a year ago. Not even a year ago, and they may still be hopeless, but they're not in a literal sense. They're not really hopeless. But I think you're right. But for now, I think we've got, you know, it's sort of like, you know, that feeling when you're just starting to get traction, when you've been spinning on the snow or the ice, and suddenly it's starting to grip because you put it in second gear, and it's like tires are starting to grip. There's a little bit of that feel, and I think a lot of the geeks of the world are the ones that are starting to feel it before some of the other folks are. So anyway, that's,
yeah. What was interesting about what you just said is that, like, for instance, Howard Dean landed a whole passel full of contribution bucks simply because he won an online straw poll.
What? Oh, wait.
The move on poll.
Which was, but there was another thing too. The way he got all the money was that they turned on comments on movable type. You know, on this open source tool, you know, on this open source blogging tool, and it was just like a judgment call. Should we turn on comments? So they turned on comments.
Yeah.
And then they turned on like PayPal or something along with the comments, and like $1 million rolled in.
That's great. I mean, you know, the other candidates should learn from Dean because he's doing the net thing pretty much right. He's wallpapering the walls with himself.
And the interesting thing I'm seeing from a lot of the geeks, I mean, there's a little group called Hackers for Dean that are involved, is, you know, they're like, okay, we're with this guy as long as he's building the barn we want to build.
Watch out.
But as soon as he wants to build a jail or he wants to build something else, well, we'll just take our keyboards and go elsewhere.
That's the fear. Because the evolution of media savvy during the 90s, we are really starting to see large numbers of candidates micromanaging their campaigns on almost a daily, and if not on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, based upon polling data.
Right.
And everything was being done by polling data.
Yeah.
You no longer had candidates with convictions and brains. They were polladates. And anybody who disagrees with that comment isn't turned on to the political.
Oh no, that was absolutely true.
Absolutely true. And my fear is that this just gives a faster, more powerful tool into the hands of pundits that are going to put these candidates on a turntable, and they're going to spin around in circles.
Well, where are the pundits and what are they doing?
Wait until they get to
the TV and radio pundits are missing it. They're still missing it. They're looking at Dean and they're looking at what's going on and saying, "Oh, he's getting money from the internet." Without even saying, "What the hell is that? How would I call it citizens?" You know, because you're not getting it from special interests.
Well, you know, if you think about TV and the TV news, and you think about how wrapped up it is with the media industry in general, you know, even the newspapers are getting that way these days. And you wonder, well, you know, IAA and the MPAA have not figured out the internet yet. Now, why in the hell would you think that the companies that run the IAA and MPAA would understand what the internet is all about?
They sure have figured out the internet, Ernie.
Well, they figured out enough of it. They put out like 1,000 subpoenas or something like that. I mean, the RIAA is going after downloaders in a huge way right now.
Yeah.
Uploaders, not downloaders.
Just up. I thought it was downloaders too. Maybe I'm wrong.
But regardless, the intellectual property industries have figured out the internet just fine. Thank you very much. They figured it out enough to know that they want to own it, control it, and change it.
Yep.
I mean, it's really that simple.
Yep.
Well, Arnie, do you have any stories of the week?
I had a couple stories, and basically Russ preempted them.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's okay. It happens. You know, and the rest of my stuff is all SCO.
Okay, well, it's already 8:30, so maybe... Russ, do you want to hit a couple more of the high points of your list, and then we'll jump right into SCO?
Yeah, I just want to highlight two of them. You can find the links on the web show page. Linux to become a de facto standard from IT director.
Good article.
And the other one is local successes across the country in local governments. And these are two interesting pieces in that they don't tell us a whole lot of new things, but they're good things to lay across your boss's desk if you happen to be in the situation where it would be helpful.
To the evangelization mode.
Yes, exactly. For advocacy, these are useful current tools. So play the cards if they fit your hand.
Point of information, the de facto standard article is from Robin Bloor of Bloor Research, which is...
Right.
He's been saying nice things about Linux recently.
Oh, been saying nice things about what?
Linux recently.
Oh, and your voice dropped off of me.
Sorry.
But that happens. Okay, well, let's go ahead and jump right into SCO and give SCO a few minutes, and it looks like we're working this out.
It's all they deserve.
It was certainly an interesting 48 hours.
They deserve a trap door.
Okay.
That's what I say. Stand here, Daryl. Hold still. Thank you.
But overall, let's just, for a moment, will you all grant me a little bit of license here, right? And just think of this entire story from the perspective of a SCO stockholder. Okay? Just do that for a moment. Okay? At the last fall, how much was SCO stock selling for? Anybody want to guess?
About the price of a can of tuna, I think.
78 cents.
Yeah.
Okay?
Cheap tuna.
78 cents. A popsicle. You know how much SCO is selling for right now?
It's over 13, isn't it?
If you don't, there is a link to the SCO stock chart on the site tonight. And just go ahead and pull it up. They're at a 52-week high. If you're a stockholder of SCO, you've got to be thinking very highly of Darl right now. Okay? Because he's doing exactly what the stockholders want the president of a company to do, and that's increase the value of the company, even if he doesn't increase sales.
Yeah, I would want the company that I own stock to have their board of directors put in jail for a RICO violation.
I just have a little advice for those stockholders. Sell.
Sell now.
Yeah. Sell now.
Yep.
Sell now. That's
Or at least put a sell order in at 15, baby.
Yeah.
I like the guy on Slashdot that said you want to trade in SCO, sell short. You know, that's very highly advisable.
Well, maybe 6 months from now.
I don't know. I think this shit's gonna hit the fan sometime soon.
Well, it will be interesting. There's no question that the next month will be interesting. SCO's got themselves in a little bit of a bind because they have promised a number of people, not me, but a number of people in media that they were finally going to come clean at their SCO event in Vegas the 17th, 18th, and 19th of August, that they were going to let people look at the source code that they're referring to without signing NDAs. And I have email in my possession telling me, yes, I'll be able to go to the event, look at things, talk to people, and not have to sign NDAs. And it will be an interesting month because one of two things is going to come out of this month. It's either SCO is going to come clean and have real evidence or not. And what might be interesting is during the next 2 weeks if you see who's selling what stock.
It would be interesting. I have this theory that if we go out a few months, we'll see a stockholder's lawsuit by the people who bought at 11. You know, after this thing fails.
You have that in all cases. You have that with
you have that in all cases, but we'll have that. Inevitable.
I look at Daryl McBride as being like Bluto of the movie Animal House, where everything has gone to hell in a handbasket, and he decides to have a toga party.
Yeah.
I mean, this is SCO is having a toga party.
It's a shakedown. It's a total shakedown. It's a shakedown.
This guy is a shark, Ernie. He's no Pluto.
I'm sorry. These guys, I see their board meeting as just being a bunch of people laughing and laughing. And what extremes can we go to artificially prop up our stock price and not get called on it?
Yeah, well, let's look at a couple of things. A couple of things that they do have going in their favor is some idiot clerk in Washington went ahead and granted him the copyright.
I think that happens automatically if anybody sends in a copyright application. That's not a big deal. I sent in a copyright application. Have you ever had one denied?
Really, a copyright is worthless until it's been challenged.
That's true. And the clerk in Washington is just doing his or her job. I mean, when you file that paperwork with the $17 or whatever it is, they send you a response saying, "Okay, it's registered." You know, registering a copyright anybody can do. I can register the copyright for Unix System 5 Unix.
Why don't you?
Well, I mean, you know, it's already been registered. You know, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's worthless to register a copyright. I mean, it's defending the copyright that's important.
Well, it certainly has given them the opportunity. Did any of you guys listen to the press conference yesterday?
No, I refused.
I didn't have the stomach for it.
I didn't want to get sick.
Then go take a look at the links on the website under News Go. A couple of the articles up there are some of the highlights of various websites. Pundits from different perspectives, both pro and anti-SCO. An interesting one was written by one of our former clueless pundits, who is still fairly clueless, from MSNBC.
Who is that?
Close the link, you'll see her name. I don't want to give her any advertising. But The MSNBC article.
Where are these links, Jeff? I was.
They're on the Linux Show website.
Okay.
And this particular pundit is taking the perspective of good for the stock price, and it has been. If you go to most of the financial websites, the first half of the story is quotes from Darrell and his legal team, and you know how wonderful this is for the future of Stowe. And then right at the very bottom of the article will be a one or two line quote from somebody like Eric Raymond.
Oh, and they usually never contact Eric Raymond.
It's
somebody who could be arguably part of the open source community.
Somebody from the community generally contacts the writer.
Yeah, but it's usually at the end, and I've noticed that too. And the reason is because a lot of these publications are into contacting businesses. There is no Linux business.
How many people in the open source community have press agents?
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what it boils down to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a way, that's sort of what Linux International is partially there to do, but they don't have any money to do it. They're supposed to be the press agent to Linux. But amazing 48 hours in that Go has really ratcheted up.
I wish the Department of Justice would start enforcing the laws, because this comes close to blackmail.
Well, you know, Arnie, until somebody actually puts an action against Go, that's not going to happen.
It has in Europe.
The laws are different in Europe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, like in Germany, they had
no class action will happen until a class of plaintiffs has been identified. No RICO case will happen until more than one business has issued an independent criminal charge. Because keep in mind, RICO is a criminal statute, not a civil statute.
Yeah.
And bottom line is, nobody's believing them enough to counter-sue. I think that's really, for good or bad.
You're saying that maybe people aren't putting much credence in what they're doing, and so they're basically saying, ignore it, maybe it'll go away.
Yeah, the people who are the Linux vendors are not paying much attention to this, because they've just never come clean on the quote-unquote 80 lines of code, which yesterday the 80 lines of code became hundreds.
They became hundreds of files.
Yeah, it's hundreds of files. Yeah, whatever hundreds of files mean. But they didn't specify anything. It's hundreds of files.
Yeah, well, and the other thing that they threw out there, too, if you read one of the latest pieces on it, is that they talk about it coming from the SCO operating system and from derivative works. And that's a very interesting phrase in the context that they were using. Well, no, as in, it sounds like, and we saw hints of this before, but it sounds like they're really trying to lay their hands on just about any Unix that's out there, and saying anything that any of these other vendors incorporated into Unix is somehow ours.
Well, they've as much as said that.
A month and a half ago, they basically insinuated they own every single piece of operating code written. That's Unix, but they own every single piece of operating system code written since the release of System 5, because they're all derivative of System 5.
Right, but by the same token, you know, a month or so ago they were talking about how BSD may be an issue, and now this week they're saying BSD isn't an issue.
Yeah, but they said the Linux wasn't an issue at one time too.
Exactly. So I mean, they're vacillating all over the place on their claims.
There's another issue with BSD, and that is that's the lawsuit that the System 5 people with upon a previous case have lost.
Right.
The Berkeley case went for BSD.
So bottom line, SCO continues to escalate. They have $10 million. They have basically enough cash to get through December, January next year. And they will have burned all their cash.
Well, all it takes is one successful countersuit.
No, they can't get a case through that fast.
No, that's true.
Okay, they cannot get a case through that fast. It is impossible. And so that's why I get really, really torqued when I see these secret releases. Well, today we found out that the secret partner that SCO was referring to about a month ago was Sun, and that Sun has licensed System 5.
Right.
And, of course, we all are totally aware of the Microsoft funding channel from a few months ago. But even with those people helping them out through license fees, unless people just fall on their backs and sign these license agreements and start pouring money into Go's coffer, Go's going to be out of business by the spring.
Yeah, but don't forget, you know, they are, allow me to put my tongue firmly in my cheek here, they are an operating business, and I'm sure that you have seen, as I have, the number of press releases that they've released about their new products, which are obviously taking over the world as we speak. So, I mean, you know, I think you're selling them short. You know, I think you got to give them at least an extra 2 weeks.
Okay.
Based on product sales. But,
okay. Well, we'll put an end to the SCO story right now. We've got to move on. Doc, how is the install going?
I assume it's going fine. It's in it's going on down in the shop. So I've been up here instead. So I'm sure it's going okay.
Okay, let's take a real short break and then come back with segment number two. And we are going to talk about embedded Linux. So everybody hang in there.
Right.
It could be a very geeky, technical half hour of conversation. So hang in there, everybody. We'll be right back.
Vanishing breath, they enter the waves. For only the drowned can be saved. The weight of their trust shall carry them swift. So deep below the ebb and flow, and their hearts start thrilling.
And we're back.
It's the Linux Show for July, the 22nd, 2003. We are back with the second segment of tonight's show. We're gonna geek out. We're gonna talk about embedded Linux, hardcore technology talk for the rest of the show. So Doc is probably gonna fade into the background and just listen in. I know you too well, Doc. But, we have. Two of the founders of the Embedded Linux Consortium here with us tonight, Murray Shohat and Rick, I can never pronounce your last name, Lirbaum.
Yeah, you got it.
I always trip over the H in the middle of your name. But two very well-known people within the Linux community, and Rick has been known forever within the Embedded industry group, but couldn't ask for two more knowledgeable people to bring us up to date of the state of the art of what's going on with embedded technologies.
Help us that address for the nice introduction check.
Yeah, click on the PayPal button. But Murray and Rick, welcome to the show again.
Thank you.
And. Well, what's up with the Embedded Linux Consortium these days?
Thank you for the question. The Embedded Linux Consortium announced last week that it was expanding its mission in the standards arena to help bring power management, user interface, and real-time standards into the mix of our work. And this announcement is taking place at a time when a group in basically out of Japan, the Consumer Electronic Linux Forum is announcing its presence and its ramp up. That forum happens to be headed up by organizations that command about an 80% market share of consumer electronics. And so we believe that between our two groups, we've made a very significant shot across the bow of other operating system companies in terms of developer interest going forward. It's a Linux world out there, and that's good news. Rick, I don't know as a journalist if that's your take on it or not.
Absolutely. I guess I'd like to invite anybody interested in taking a look at some of the data. Take a look at linuxdevices.com. On the front page of the site, on the right-hand column, you'll find something that looks like a bar graph. It's titled The Embedded Linux Market. If you click there, there's a lot of good data available on how well Embedded Linux is doing. Basically, it is quickly on its way to being in the top spot for embedded operating systems.
The top spot, you said?
Yeah. It's gonna get there. It's in the top two or three, depending on how you poll it and who you ask. Wind River Systems has traditionally, not traditionally, but for many, many years, been the number one commercial operating system, but they have not been the number one market share in the embedded Linux, the embedded market. In fact, not invented here, well, not, no, I'm sorry, non-commercial has been the number one segment of the embedded market. It's basically roll-your-own embedded OS has been number one, and that is vanishing quickly and being taken over by Linux because it
Who can afford to do it?
Yeah, right. And it, the kinds of functionality that you need now in devices and embedded systems with connectivity, Ethernet instead of serial ports, you know, PCMCIA instead of simpler expansion. You just need the greater sophistication, and Linux gives it to you free. So it's taking over what used to be the dominant share of the market, and it's just about there.
So where's this link on the...
In the right-hand column on the front page of Linux devices, about
okay.
a third of the way down, you see a green and blue bar chart, embedded Linux market.
Okay.
Right above the ELJ online.
Okay.
All
right.
And it's the second chart down in the actual article.
Okay, got it. Yeah.
And this
embedded
is not...
OS trends.
The raw data is available for this survey, but what I've done is pick out a few things that I think are really significant, and you can see the decline in, well, what we see here is that there's no commercial vendor that's number one in embedded Linux, that in fact it's homegrown embedded Linux, and that's because it's being fueled by homegrown operating system interest.
It's so easy to compile the kernel for special technologies.
The modularity is a key virtue in the embedded space, especially where you have everything ranging from extremely tiny footprints on up to gargantuan sized embedded systems.
In Linux,
is that an oxymoron?
I suppose it is. but many people assume, I have conversations daily with people who think embedded always means tiny footprint, and it's not the case. You can find military systems that look for all the world like your biggest multiprocessor enterprise systems.
That's true.
And the interesting thing about embedded is if you look at where the world's processors or microprocessors are located, many, many more are in embedded systems than on desktops or servers.
They're in your washing machine. They're in your toaster.
Yeah, do you guys know what the ratio is, by the way, that the Semiconductor Industry Association puts out?
No, it'd be interesting. What is it?
It's more than 90% of the microprocessor microcontrollers produced by the world semiconductor companies go into embedded sockets. More than 90% of them. So the Pentium crowd is a very small portion of the overall market.
Oh, sure.
Well, what are those things? More than 90%? 90% of all the embedded, more than 90% of all of the
microprocessors and microcontrollers made get jobs in the embedded market.
Well, wasn't it just a couple of years ago the 4-bit CPU finally dropped out of its dominant number one position?
Yeah, I think the Z80 was number one until pretty recently.
It was like 2 years ago or 3 years ago, yeah.
That's the only one I know how to program, so that's good.
There's an 8-bit, there's an 8-bit DIP package that has an 8051 processor.
I receive inquiries weekly on how to port Linux to the 8051. It isn't going to die in my life.
So there, by the way, there's a very cool implementation of Linux called UC Linux.
Yeah, micro. Yeah, that's a great. It runs on a loosely out of the Palm Pilot thing, where they the Dragon Ball, the Motorola Dragon Ball processor did not have a memory management unit. So these people developed a micro C Linux, which doesn't require memory management.
What I've seen in this device, it's really one of the most popular variants of Linux and embedded systems. It keeps turning up over and over and over again. We do device profile stories, and it's just amazing how often news comes out about this or that UC Linux device, or software support, or drivers, or breakthroughs in various technologies. It's very popular. And as you said, it doesn't require an MMU, and it also, by virtue of that, uses a lot less in terms of system resources.
You can run it on your Palm 3.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah, and believe it or not, these are the very characteristics that attracted the Sonys and Panasonic, Sharps, Samsungs, Philips, etc., etc., to form the CELF. They know that they are going to have to do something, competitively speaking, from a business strategy standpoint, to enable their smart devices going forward, and Linux looks like it has the greatest potential. And of course, there's a sordid history in Japan, in particular, with operating systems. I don't know if any of you have heard of Tron.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to solve that problem now by being very, very global, and that's why they've formed this consortium, and they're doing their thing, and we're doing our thing.
It's nice to see the backing of such large corporations in the industry. I mean, it basically is the whole core of the industry right there, that new consortium in Japan.
Yeah, Rick, am I wrong when I express my feeling that it's one of the most fundamental consortium announcements in my 30-year career in the embedded market? How about yours?
It's very significant. It's certainly very significant. We just haven't seen those kinds of things. And I think you're right that Tron had that angle to it, but it was really, as we've discussed before, kind of localized more in Japan. But the announcements that are going on today of a global nature, the ELC is very significant, and the CELF initiative is very significant. CELF, by the way, stands for Consumer Electronics Linux Forum. So that's the Japanese and some other major electronics manufacturers that have banded together to work on some enhancements to Linux for embedded for entertainment type devices.
Yeah, Rick, I'm glad you brought that up, because some people have said, why do you need them if you have the ELC? And the answer is that they're working on Linux enhancements, whereas our group is working on application programming interfaces. And both are important, but they are distinctly separate.
Like why you need Linux.
That's it. There's been a question in the chat room, in the RC room, about recent claims that embedded Windows has a lower total cost of ownership than embedded Linux.
Oh yes. And that study, of course, was funded by
Guess who?
Guess who? But you know, I have some thoughts on that. I think that Microsoft was probably behind even inspiring that study, and they probably did have some market intelligence that said some customers were concerned that they ended up spending more money on their projects using Linux than they normally would have using, a traditional embedded operating system. So there are costs associated with developing software using Linux. That ain't free. Linux is. But developing a system isn't free. And there's lots of ways of explaining why data might show that. But
is there anything about holding down, back when I was around the business, holding down NRE was like a really big issue. I assume it still is to some extent. Does Linux have any particular advantages there?
Well, sure. Sure it does.
Yeah, I would imagine.
One of the articles that we recently updated at Linux Devices is about Linux being free as in beer. If you go to the articles area and put the keyword in beer and click view, you'll get the update on where's the free beer, which talks about all the ways you can work with embedded Linux without having to shell out, spend money on royalties or on even on tools.
If there is a dislocation of sorts due to the older versus newer paradigm in dealing with operating systems. Linux is admittedly weak on the tools front, but it's getting stronger on a daily basis, and it's getting stronger in the open source methodology as well, where you have the meritocracy working on tools that once published are superb out of the chute. And so the problems that are cited in the report that you're talking about they're false in my opinion, and I believe that the falsity of some of the content of the report can be seen in the fact that the industry has chosen to not respond to it. You can't find any major vendor saying yet anything about that report or attempting to fight back or to offer countervailing opinion. Rick, you're a journalist on a daily basis. Maybe you know of something coming down the pike, but it's already been a week, and none of the people in our membership have chosen to respond. And I think that's a very significant fact.
I've talked to a few vendors, and in fact, some of them say, well, of course Linux costs money. And in fact, Microsoft is selling their tool for $995, and you might easily spend more than that getting an embedded Linux vendor's toolkit, and it may very well be worth a lot more than that. You can get it free, and you can get it from multiple vendors. There's a whole other side to the Linux story, but I think that report chooses a very narrow way of looking at it, and it's really not an analyst report. It's an advertorial or infomercial.
And I remember on page 14 or 15 of that report, by the way, it's only 23 pages long, so it's not very substantial, but on one page in particular, they announced that they're not going to look at the royalty cost of Windows Embedded XP at all. They just leave that number out of their calculation.
Oh, geez.
So convenient.
Well, you know, in case people don't know it, Microsoft dropped their royalty for a core component of Windows CE without a GUI, but it was, you could do something like a router with it, to $3, and that's the asking price. And so now they're saying, well, if you add everything together, all you have to do is buy a toolkit or rent a toolkit from MontaVista or one of the Linux vendors. You've spent more up front than what Microsoft says their price is, which is $995.
And anybody who's priced development systems, embedded development systems, ever, you go into a sticker shock at the cost of some of these things. And the fact of the matter is, these companies that are developing these things aren't cranking them out by the millions like Sony or you know, Panasonic. They're literally cranking them out in the hundreds, so the cost per unit is way up. And development system hardware, basically development hardware for embedded, is the price of admission is high.
That's an absolutely excellent point. I come out of the portion of the embedded market that has often seen itself as a low to moderate volume arena with one-off style design and pricing. And it's the consumer electronics domain that is driving this industry from a volume standpoint, and there still are a lot of practitioners who, for example, are designing automated fare collection boxes for 35,000 buses per year maximum opportunity. Well, 35,000 buses is hardly a big order compared to a new PDA that does a lot of things and runs on the Linux operating system or a cell phone.
And then that's a good point, because 35,000 units, it wouldn't be enough to, for like a company like any of these large electronics firms, CES firms, that wouldn't be enough to justify even a look-see as to what it would cost to develop it, let alone putting together a prototype.
Out in the chat room, there has been some discussion. People want to know about user interfaces in the embedded space. Is there a clear leader right now, and what are the choices out there?
There's a bunch of stuff. We've got a quick reference guide at Linux Devices on a GUI and windowing software for embedded, and it's pretty divergent. Qt Embedded and Qtopia, partly thanks to the Zaris, seem to be very popular among the sort of end-user-oriented devices. When you think about embedded systems, sometimes they don't have any display, sometimes they have LEDs, sometimes a little text. And then sometimes they have more like a full graphic display. There are versions of X that you can use, frame buffer, direct frame buffer access. There's micro windows.
There's XFCE. There's tons of them.
There's a whole quick reference guide devoted to that at Linux Devices. Again, it's on the right-hand column, and you can click down. It's right above that graph that I was talking about before.
Don't forget curses.
Yeah, in our discussion going into the press release I mentioned at the opening, for user interfaces, we've just pre-decided that a series of profiles will have to be built that attempt to characterize the market in terms of fully headless to fully headed GUIs. And that's going to be an interesting table. Some people have attempted to build one before, but now we're going to have some of the world's leading companies putting technologists and marketing people into a room, locking the door behind them and not letting them out until they define GUIs for Linux.
They're never going to get let out of that room. It's impossible, Murray.
Just throw a raw piece of meat in every day and
no, pizza and beer for these guys.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, pizza and beer.
There's so many alternatives. It's what are you going to do? What can you possibly do? I don't know. I think it's going to be a lot of fun to see what I think it's a good idea to try, but I think it's going to be fun to see what comes out of the GUI effort.
What about the processors? There's a lot been happening on the ARM front. Advanced RISC machines designs in the embedded market, and Intel seems to be trying to leverage in there too with their processor. It's something scale.
X-scale, which
X-scale.
is based on strong ARM, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't forget Motorola.
In Motorola, the Dragon Ball and their derivatives.
I've got a graph on that, too. That same survey that I was telling you about earlier, it shows past 2 years, next 2 years data in where processors are going. And x86 for embedded Linux is number one, but it's not growing as fast as the others. ARM is second. PowerPC is third. MIPS is kind of flat, but there's a little action in MIPS. And Super H has been doing some interesting things.
Hitachi has a couple.
Renesis.
Yeah. What's interesting about the is the diversity of processors. Now, because of the diversity of processors that the embedded market is using, and because the scales are way low in numbers as far as but very high in number of projects. Wouldn't you think that would work against the Windows platform, which is only built on one particular technology?
Yes and no. Yes, absolutely for the higher end systems. Microsoft made a strategic decision a few years ago to put it to Motorola and not support PowerPC anymore on Windows Server or mainstream Windows. And they still don't. The Windows XP Embedded is Microsoft's modular version of Windows regular, and that is, of course, an x86 world. But they also have Windows CE, sometimes called CE.NET.
Yeah.
That isn't Windows. It's got some Win32 API-ness about it, and they're trying to share APIs going forward, but it's a whole new, fresh OS for the embedded space, and it doesn't scale up to server level at all. It's really for embedded devices, and they're using it to go after smartphones and PDAs, telematics, automotive, GPS, map drawing things, maybe set-top boxes. They support the same basic set of processors, but heaven help you if you need something that that isn't on their list. So, and their list is obviously going to be governed by major vendors and quantities. Microsoft has to be quantity oriented.
Yeah, so the heaven help you thing is very important. From day one, when Rick and I got together several months in advance of actually launching the Embedded Linux Consortium, it became very clear very early that the key differentiating value we had going in was that our group could see the source code. And that remains true today. And when you add to that the diversity of microprocessors that are available, the ability to see and change the source code, my goodness, you know, if you were an author and you wanted to write on any topic, you couldn't find a better environment than one that has as many variables as the Linux environment in the embedded space. It's just a wonderful place to be, and I'm sure hoping that our friends at SCO don't kill it for us. What do you guys think?
Oh, no, let's go. I have to go, and I'll just bet that they won't kill it for us. They'll just soak up all the conversational energy for this year.
Yeah, Murray, what are you using the S word for?
Well, it was advertised tonight. I thought somebody ought to say it.
Oh, yeah.
It was instead of the M word.
I just to return again.
My
initials, by the way, Rick, are MS, so I'm on both sides of that issue.
Another comment on Microsoft's response is they're taking embedded Linux very seriously. I think Microsoft is way, way ahead of Linux. I think it's clear in the PDA space and, of course, in the smartphone space, but that's about it. And they're reacting very strongly to Linux and to what they see as the strength of the Linux community. They've opened up CE.NET source code substantially and even made it possible for there to be shared projects, so that you can share not just source, but binaries. And I'd like to see that tested, not legally, but in terms of can you really conduct an open project using, could you take CE.NET and put it on the HP iPack, for example, as an alternative to Pocket PC? Well, Microsoft wouldn't probably like you to do that, but maybe you could.
Why? That's the question. Why?
Exercise. Aren't we geeks?
Look at the Xbox, right?
I want to port CE.NET to my washing machine, you know.
Well, I just want to make a couple of general comments about... Well, first of all, let's talk about LinuxDevices.com just a minute. I want to congratulate you on the find it job done there, in terms of the real depth and quality of the information you now have at LinuxDevices.com. That's pretty incredible.
Gee, thanks.
And on the other website for your Embedded Linux Foundation, we have a link.
ELC, embeddedlinux.com.org.
Yes. We have a link up there at the website. If people will take a quick look, you can go to the Embedded Linux Consortium website.
Can I interject something that nobody knows? You can get to our website by simply typing in embedlinuxnow.com as one word. Embedlinuxnow.com. Rick doesn't even know this.
That's good if your keyboard doesn't have a hyphen.
There are no hyphens in that.
That's why it's good.
Yes.
But if you're interested in this space, you should go to the Embedded Linux Consortium website, fill out the membership application, and join.
Codebase supporters get in for free.
There you go.
There you go. That's pretty cool.
That's a great, very responsible policy. I mean, a lot of these technology consortiums seem to only want to get the large corporations, so they want to leverage that, so they make the price of admission so large that small developers can't get involved.
Well, in their defense.
Yeah, there's a reason
money
for that.
Talks, you know?
Yeah.
You're a consortium, you need to do things. And
need
money.
But when you're in a business that is depending on an open source development, it's very responsible to say, okay, come on in, developers.
Sure. We need members. Rick needs advertisers. There is no free lunch.
That's right. Yeah.
That's it. I get embedded Linux Programming magazine every month. It's wonderful. You've seen that one. that's where I get my news.
Printed in 6 months.
Huh?
Here.
I got one the other 2 months ago.
Really?
You mean embedded systems program?
Yeah, embedded systems program.
Yeah, the CMP publication. That's a sister to EE Times.
Yeah, and it's really nice. It's a good magazine in there. It's almost all Linux now these days.
It's very tools oriented. It's wonderful in that regard.
Yeah, it's really really geeky. I like it.
It's amazing how everything is going Linux in the embedded space, considering that Microsoft has proven through their funded study that can't happen.
that it's impossible.
Yeah, it's impossible. Costs more.
Hey, let me ask a geeky question here. For someone who's a Linux programmer who hasn't done anything in the embedded world, and he's looking to go into some form of embedded Linux work, what's the major difference? What's going to be the technical culture shock of dealing with embedded Linux for the first time?
It isn't embedded Linux that'll be a shock in any way. It's really getting to know embedded systems in
real time.
They are
constraints of memory. Time. Yeah, it could be real time. It could be, you know, very often it's resource constraints. You think differently. But a lot of embedded isn't really that constrained. You know, there are set-top boxes, PVRs, that have more functionality in them than our PCs had a couple of years ago.
So desktop Linux engineering are like the 101 courses at the university. Embedded Linux engineering is often like the advanced 301 courses at a university. There's a lot of challenges that you don't see coming up in the enterprise and desktop space, and those challenges can be intellectually very satisfying. I also might add, from my own experience, the embedded market generally pays a little bit better than the enterprise and desktop engineering market.
Well, it's because it's the heart of a $600 billion industry. I mean, that helps, doesn't it?
There are some very cool and not too expensive platforms that you can also get that may come with an embedded Linux implementation with Source, so you can start fooling around with it. There's always discussions in the forum at Linux Devices about pieces of hardware that you can get. Some are a couple $100.
Yeah.
But, you know, get out of ours and play with it.
To contradict my earlier statement that these things are expensive, there are some inexpensive ones you can get that based on some more.
Dr. Dobbs' journal is a good place to go for the inexpensive end.
Yes, and embedded systems programming has a bunch of stuff in.
They're having a sale at, who is it? The Surf Cube from Intrinsic. They've got one that they put on sale, and
Honey,
it's a really cool thing to play with.
That's cute. It's called Honey, I Shrunk the Linux System.
I saw a Linux box for $129 somewhere today.
$169.
$169?
But it wasn't as cute as the Surf Cube.
Yeah. No, it's got a CD in it that you can't remove. That's the Lindos box.
Yeah.
Released in Japan, I guess.
Yeah, very, very cool. Well, gentlemen, it is almost 9:30, just a couple minutes away from 9:30, so we do have to wrap it up and put our farewell tune on for the evening and say our good night to our listeners. But I do want to thank you for coming on again, and it's always interesting to have you on the show. The time seems to really, really fly when we've got you here. So let's not wait so long in the future. Come back sooner next time. And it might be interesting even for us to do a little homework ahead of time and search out a couple of the vendors that are members of the consortium and get them involved with the conversation as well. That might be an interesting conversation. So on behalf of the whole crew here, boy, I really appreciate the both of you coming out tonight and
welcome.
Giving us some of your valuable family time to the Linux show. So thanks a lot for coming out.
And good to be on again.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And I'd like to again thank all of the listeners out there. A couple of real quick updates just before we shut down for the night. Make sure you are coming back during the course of the next couple of weeks. Got some special announcements that we're going to be making. a couple of interesting marketing ideas that we're doing. Dave from New Zealand will be happy to know that I've hooked up with a vendor from New Zealand to do a special promotion for the Linux show. I'm not going to link that one out. But hopefully by next week, we're going to be releasing a official Linux show line of clothing. And so
available only in extra, extra large, right?
Sizes 2X to 5X. That's what I've asked the vendor for. And so I'm trying to work out those details. And, of course, your ever proverbial lunchbox. Got to have the Linux show lunchbox. But
I would like that.
But make sure you check back during the course of the next couple weeks, because we're going to have some really fun ways for you to participate as listeners and actually be able to buy gifts to give your friends. And I've got some well-known geek artists who are designing the artwork for our stuff right now. But more news on that in the coming weeks. Make sure you check us out same time next week, Tuesday, for the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show. We'll be back same time. Everybody, we're out of here.